Hey, 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 welcome back to the AIMP Nashville Pubcast. This is your host, Tim Hunzie. We have a good one for you today, friends. We are sitting with Chris Dubois, hit songwriter, iconic music publisher. I think you're really going to enjoy what we dig into. We not only talk about publishing, how to set up a publishing company, but we also talk about how to be a great songwriter, how to take criticism, really deep dive into a lot of things. So I hope you enjoy it. So buckle up and enjoy the ride. Hey, 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 welcome back to the AIMP Nashville Pubcast. This is your host, Tim Hunzie, and we have a fun episode for you today. We are sitting with my buddy, Chris Dubois, who's one of the founding members of Seagale Music Publishing. Also, I have to add, hit songwriter as well, and dad of five kids. So he wears many, many hats. And just a little background on Seagale. This company is now 26 years old, and as he and I were just talking about, that is one of the older independent publishers still standing in today's environment, which is pretty impressive. Not to mention that you guys have started off the careers or been a part of careers of some of the greater songwriters in our business, and not yourself included, but of course, a little guy named Brad Paisley. And of course, Frank Rogers was a part of the early days, but like Stapleton, Lee Thomas Miller, my good buddy Clint Daniels, and Brent Anderson. I mean, it goes on and on. You guys have really been a place for some of the best. Oh, I should add Bobby Pinson, or he'll hate me.
My good
buddy Bobby P. But you guys have been a part of so many hit songwriters' career. And I think you might can improve this, but I did my internet research, which sometimes can be wrong. Says you've had 40 plus number ones at this point, probably somewhere in there.
Our publishing company, I think we're past the 50 mark. We're nowhere near Ashley Corley status. But we're not really keeping tabs at this point like we used to.
Update your website,
I'm waiting on somebody smarter than me to go in and update it for us, and it just doesn't automatically happen. We need to update that.
I felt that seemed shy, because I think I've known you've had a few here recently, so I'm like, that doesn't seem right. But 50, right. Yeah, man, that's rocking and rolling right there. I think when we sold the final sale of the old catalog, sure, Hamstein, that I worked with, we'd reached a 64 number once, and that was such a thing back then. It was impressive.
Sure, but it is.
Welcome aboard, Chris. Glad to have you today. I usually start this off by just having my guests give a little bit of background on themselves. I've learned never to assume that people know us still. So, my friend, what got you to where you're at today?
Well, I mean, I'll start back in the childhood days. You know, I'm always impressed by music executives and songwriters that uproot from somewhere in the Midwest or somewhere other than Music Row area and risk it all from a non-musical family to take a gamble on the music business. That was not me, but it was my dad. I came to Nashville in the backseat of a Vega station wagon as my dad left Oklahoma to pursue a dream as a songwriter. So I'm a second generation songwriter, music executive, but we moved to town when I was 6 years old. So I grew up here in Nashville around songwriters. And, you know, my father went on to become a record producer and manager and ultimately a record executive. So my music business education came really just through being around him and growing up around it. I went to school and studied accounting up in Knoxville at the University of Tennessee, had summer jobs prior to that cutting grass, but I fell in love with country music. And just through the assistance of my father, I was able to get a tape copy job at Polygram Music Publishing in the late 80s. And that was a $5 an hour job. That was kind of my fast track education in the publishing business, at least the creative side of it. And I got to work in the tape copy room and see what a culture in the heyday of country music looked like at a publishing house. And that was a lot of fun. I mean, Bob McDill was writing at Polygram at the time, and Costas and Jim Rushing, and just legendary songwriters. So I got to see them come in and turn in their work tapes. And I would take literally a raw quarter inch tape and cut it into a reel to reel. And that's how we stored the catalog. And Tim, I know you're very familiar with that.
I had that journey myself. Yep.
Yes. And I would splice the new songs on the end of the reels until they ran out of space on the reels and start a new one. And I would make cassette copies of the reel to reels, and then I'd deliver them down the road to producers and record labels. And that was my introduction to publishing. I studied accounting at the University of Tennessee. I knew I wasn't going to want to work in accounting, but it just came relatively natural to me because my dad was actually an accounting professor while he was writing songs. But when I graduated from University of Tennessee, I worked in accounting at O'Neill Hageman for about a year, and then I got a job at ASCAP. I was hired as the director of membership at ASCAP. I was in my early 20s. One of the first people I met working in membership at ASCAP was Brad Paisley. He was an intern at ASCAP while he was going to school at Belmont, and he and I became quick friends. That led to he and I writing songs together. We met Frank Rogers, who was also at Belmont. The three of us worked nonstop in the studio. We were working at the EMI facilities because Frank was interning at EMI. Along the way, Brad signed a publishing deal with EMI, and about the time that his publishing deal was coming up, he was getting signed to a record deal at Arista, and we had this harebrained idea to start a publishing company. And so in 1999, the three of us, Brad Paisley and Frank Rogers and I, established Seagill Music as a joint venture with EMI. It was the three of us. The first two writers we signed were Trent Willman and Tim Owens. And then I think the next year we signed Don Sampson and Jay Knowles. Then we signed Moose Brown. It wasn't long thereafter that we signed Chris Stapleton to his first publishing deal. It was a pretty successful, crazy first 5 years as a company. All the while, as a joint venture with EMI, we extended our deal with EMI for another 5 years. And in 2010, we went full independent. It was crazy because at that point, I didn't really think beyond us being a joint venture. I just assumed that we would probably sell somewhere along the way and get swallowed up by a major. And it didn't happen. We got to the end of the 10-year relationship with EMI. We went independent. And then in 2011, we won ASCAP Publisher of the Year.
Which, can I just interject here? I just want to say, I don't want that to pass by, because that I remember that moment with pride, because Hamsine almost won BMI. We were three awards shy. And independents hadn't done that. I think it was the 80s was the last time that had happened at a small right. company.
Windswept, if I remember correct, Windswept did it. I want to say it had been 35 years since it had happened.
Which is insane. And I don't think it's happened since. You guys did it twice, I should add.
We did it back to back. We did it in 2011 and again in 2012. And we were slated to win a third year in a row. And then EMI and Sony merged.
Oh, that's right.
Yes. And that kept us
man,
on stage.
Man, sticking it to you, man.
Yeah, I know. I knew at that point that it was very unlikely for it to happen again as the large companies merged. But there for a minute, man, we were the little man up on that stage. And that was, of all the things that I've been fortunate enough to do and accomplish in my career, those two nights winning Publisher of the Year are still my two proudest moments.
What was the itch that, you know, you said you obviously grew up in it, but were you writing along the way, or is this something that just sort of happened naturally, or was it, you know, because you obviously had a business sense. Was there a chicken or the egg there for you, or has it just always been one same thing for you?
No, my path was very different. You know, growing up around it with my father writing songs, you know, I went through my phases as a listener of music as a teenager, from my hip hop phase to my metal phase. And when I got into high school, I started running with a group of guys that listened to country music, which I thought was unusual at the time. And I remember distinctly having a sleepover at one of those guys' houses, and we were all just kind of splayed out on the basement floor, and he had a country radio station playing like in the background while we were all sleeping, laying there and hearing a Restless Heart song play that my dad wrote. And there was something about that that kind of resonated with me, like, they like this music. For me, it was just background music to my life. And I remember after that, I started listening to country radio and became a quick student of songwriters and started paying attention to credits. And we would get radio and records, the charts at the house. And I would, as soon as they came to the house, I would take them to my bedroom and I would just study them and study how they worked. I'd look at all the songs going for ads. And I became a real student of songs and songwriters. And that, you know, led me to my publishing tape copy job that I referenced. And in the back of my mind, I romanticized writing, and I would sit down and try to write songs by myself, but I never really thought it was something that I was going to do or take seriously, because the business side just came more naturally to me, because it was what I was already doing. And it wasn't until I started working at ASCAP when I was forced to critique songs. And again, no one's trained on how to critique songs. That's a tough spot to be put in, especially when you're 22 years old. And I'm sitting across the table from a 45-year-old guy that just drove down from Michigan, and I'm listening to his songs, and I'm supposed to tell him whether he should be meeting with publishers or not. It's very intimidating. But the first few months I worked at ASCAP, I just shadowed the other ASCAP reps and watched them do it. And I became a student of how they critiqued and who was good at it and who I thought was not very good at it. I'm not going to mention any names. But when it came time for me to start critiquing songs, I just learned that all I could do was just be honest and tell them what I thought and explain song structure, which I did understand song structure. But even just what kept songs from being good and what kept good songs from being great, and just trying to help identify those things to these writers. It was around that time when I met Brad. And when Brad and I first met, he was the first guy my age that was as knowledgeable about country music as I was. And I don't mean that to be boastful at all. It's just that all my buddies love country music, but they didn't really, you know, study it like I did. So when I met Brad and he had the same knowledge base as I did about songwriters and great songs, and we'd sit and we'd talk about songs and songwriters and play songs for each other that we loved. And that was where we first hit it off. And then he came into ASCAP one day holding a guitar. And he never mentioned that he was a player or writer or singer. And I said, "Do you write?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "I did not know that. Why didn't you say anything?" He said, "Well, I just didn't want to bring it up. I'm here working as an intern." And I said, "Well, play me something." So he played me something in my office at ASCAP. And by that time, I'd been in enough writer meetings that I was on kind of autopilot when it came critiquing. So while he was playing it, I'll never forget it. He played me a song called "Before I Heard Your Name." If he listens to this, he's going to laugh. But the song wasn't great, but there were a couple of great lines. I actually got goosebumps listening to him sing it. And that was the first time that that had happened since I'd been at ASCAP. But there were elements of the song that immediately, you know, I thought I had comments for him when he got done. And what's interesting about critiquing songs is watching how the writers process those criticisms, because a lot of writers see it as dejection or rejection and they come off as dejected. And then you've got the way that Brad reacted. And it was the first time that I'd given feedback where I felt like his eyes just kind of opened up and he'd pick his guitar up and just start changing it right there on the spot. And then he played me in a couple other things. He played me the chorus to a song called "Another You," which he brought with him to town. And that ended up being a song that David Kirsch recorded and had a top five on. But the funny thing about that song was he couldn't figure the verses out. And after that day, when he came in and played me those songs and I gave him feedback on what he played me, he started coming in every day and he'd run the new verse on "Another You" past me. So what do you think about this? And then I would just give him feedback. I'd say, "Well, that just didn't feel right." And I'd tell him what I thought. And that led ultimately to he and I writing together. And the first song we ever wrote was a song called "The Mistakes You'll Have to Live With." And it was a song that he had started, and I knew where he got the idea because my ex-girlfriend at the time had just got married, and it was a bizarre story on how I found out and all that. And he wrote a song about that. And when he played it for me, I felt a sense of ownership of that song And that led to he and I writing that song. And that led to he and I writing basically every night. We were both single. We didn't have girlfriends. So all we did was just, I'd go to ASCAP, I'd work all day. I'd go to a showcase, I'd go to the gym, and then I'd go to his house and we'd write till 3 o'clock in the morning. And we just did that every night. I was working in the music business during the day, and then I would write songs from like 10 o'clock at night till 3 in the morning. And I just did that for about 5 years nonstop.
You have been doing this for 26 years at one place, at this great company, and you have seen challenges and changes. I would love like just kind of your view of what are some of the good things you've seen change, some of the challenges you've seen, and how you as Seagale and Chris Dubois have overcome some of these challenges, because there's been, you have seen it all in your 26 years, man, as a publisher.
I've seen it all, but you know, it's amazing how much the business has changed in that amount of time. This is the first thing that comes to mind is nothing new. When we first started Seagale back in 99, and we hired our first song plugger, which was Lizzo Sullivan. Then we hired Joe Fisher for a year, and then it was Steve Williams for a year. And then, we had a variety of other pluggers. But Liz, you know, became our creative team leader for a long time. Even during that time, everybody kept their own book, and they kept it with a pencil and a day planner, and they booked their own rights. That's how everybody did it until we signed Stapleton. Chris Stapleton and Liz had a very unique relationship, and they were close. Liz knew Chris well enough to know that he wasn't going to book his own rights, that she was going to book him for him. He would call her every day and this was before iPhones. He would call her every day to see who he was riding with and where he needed to be, or she would call him. And that was a new philosophy for us as a company, because we just didn't keep the writers' calendars. We might recommend co-writes or might make phone calls, but at the end of the day, the writers would have to schedule it themselves. But when Liz started doing that with Stapleton, and he started having success, because he quickly started getting more cuts than anybody else in the company, myself included. And the other writers took notice. And it wasn't long before the other writers started coming in saying, hey, would you mind keeping my book? Would you mind booking my rights? And next thing you know, over the course of probably the next 5 years, that became a focus of what we did, is we turned into calendar managers. And that is something that is, I would say, has grown to the importance of being 70% of how publishers are spending their times, are creating opportunities in rooms and managing writers' schedules and trying to get them into new writing camps and break through walls where they're continually running into them. That's what I feel like the main focus of what we do is. Now, pitching songs is always going to be crucial and important. And, we're always going to stress the importance of that. But, I mean, calendar management has become such an important asset for the writers, and that's, our primary focus.
Having the time at one place, and particularly with one company, as you know, mine was a life of transition. What is some advice you can give on for people that want to start an independent publishing company, and like for now in our marketplace today, because you've seen it like it was, you've obviously been able to pivot. What are some of the challenges you've seen? How have you overcome them as a publisher? And what's some advice you could give? That's kind of a three-parter, I guess. Like just tell us your viewpoint from your vantage point as a hit publisher and songwriter. How, if you were going to start a publishing company in today's environment, what's some advice you would give?
Well, my advice hasn't changed much over the course of the years. I mean, I remember, I'm not going to say we were pioneers by any means, because companies like Patrick Joseph Music and Little Big Town were joint ventures that preceded ours. Little Big Town was successful to the point of selling, and Kerry O'Neill, one of the partners in that company, established Big Yellow Dog even before Seagale Music got started. So we were not pioneers in that regard, but came to, starting something from scratch, we did get a lot of people's attention. So after about 5 to 10 years, I can remember numerous occasions when people would call and just want to pick my brain about how to start a publishing company. And I had a couple of pluggers come in that had a vision to start a publishing company. They were both song pluggers that were working for other companies, and they had this business plan laid out. And I told them, I said, look, I said, your biggest liability, to be honest with you, is both of you and the salaries that you're going to need, because that's a big ticket item right off the top. Because unless you're willing to take a pay cut, that's going to be a lot of money and overhead. Why do you need two song pluggers? You don't even have a catalog at this point. Mm-hmm. They had this vision for partnering together and starting a company, but they didn't understand the math. I said, you're going to sign a writer. You're going to have to build a catalog. And how are you going to do that? I mean, it's going to take a few years to really start getting any kind of meaningful pool of songs to start pitching. Then they've got to be on hold, and then they've got to get cut, and then they've got to get released. I mean, it'll be years, three you or four before you start. Exactly right. You're looking at year three or four before you actually start seeing any money coming through the pipeline. Are your investors going to be patient enough to be that deep in the red? I just don't, you know, it's really tough math equation. Now, the biggest asset for the three of us, and Brad and Frank and I, was the fact that we were all three writers. And, you know, even I was really the one that was focused on the business of the publishing. Frank had his production, and he was still tied in to EMI Productions for a while. Brad was an artist. We didn't have any salaries. And I was getting like half salary, half writer's draw. We were getting free office space from EMI as a joint venture perk. And we just had very little overhead. So we were recouped by like year three. I mean, we were in the black quickly because we had activity. What you didn't see before we put a sign in the yard and called it CL Music, we had 5 years of writing songs and Brad getting a record deal. And the day we opened our door, his first single was Hooney's Pictures, and that was a song written by all three partners. So we were generating revenue on day one, and that was a really unique situation. But Rusty Gaston came to me along the way, and he was very smart. You know, Rusty was a great song plugger, had been pitching songs for a long time, and he saw the formula and made sense of it. And he realized if he partnered with a couple of hit songwriters, that that would help his bottom line and help him get an established writer in the door without paying him an arm and a leg and giving him an equity stake in the company. And that's what he did. He partnered with Tim Nichols and Connie Harrington, and that ended up paying huge dividends for Rusty. And he grew this music into one of the most successful independent companies in town. And of course, now he's over at Sony running the show there. But I mean, I would say this to somebody who's wanting to start a company. It's like, you don't need brick and mortar office space. You can run a publishing company from an extra bedroom in your house and, you know, spend as little money as you can. I mean, if you can you get a couple of writers that you believe in and you feel confident that you can get their songs out the door and get them pitched and get them placed, the lower you can keep your overhead, if you can get some activity going before you really start trying to invest heavily in things that have really no return, such as office space. I just don't think it's important right off the bat. If you can just find some writers you believe in, you can start it that way. And there's the other path is the hit songwriter path that wants to branch off as an independent publisher, you know, instead of signing with a major or signing a publishing deal period, they want to do their own thing and start signing writers. That's another path too, but the challenge remains the same as how do you keep overhead low.
How do you view the importance of indies in the Nashville climate, in the Nashville scene and community? Like you being a part of it and seeing all this transition, how do you view us as, what is the importance of the indie publisher?
Well, I feel like independent music publishers are really the key to all of the independent music publishing, you know, community is the culture. It's the culture within the buildings. It's the family vibe. That is the one thing. And I just had this conversation in a meeting this afternoon with a writer and a manager that I was meeting with. You know, that is what I'm most proud of as far as our company is concerned, is the culture that we built and maintained and the relationships that exist amongst the staff and the writers. And it's tough sometimes because you get really emotionally connected with these writers. And, you know, the writer-publisher relationship is not intended to last forever. So when that road runs out, it can be painful to have to part ways. You've been down that road many times yourself, Tim, I know. But it's tough sometimes. But I wouldn't change it for anything. And I feel like the independent music publishing companies are where you find those types of cultures, that it's really not a slight against the majors, but there's only so much family and community that you can create when you're a huge conglomerate publishing company. I feel like Rusty, coming from the independent music publishing world, has done a really good job over at Sony of trying to carry that on. But even still, there's only so much he can do in a company the size of Sony. But I feel like that's the flag that we still wave. It's the attention that we give the writers that the larger companies just don't have the bandwidth to provide. That's what I think we bring to the table more than anything.
The AIMP Nashville Pubcast is hosted by yours truly, Tim Hunzey. Producer, Brandon Harrington. Mixing and editing by Casey Porter. And this has been a Dime Collective production.